We have with us Jeff Deist. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, David. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well, too. And hey, you know, it's almost here. It's the event of the century, the one we've been waiting for, where all of our hopes and dreams will be settled. We'll just come together, and we will find the right Messiah from on high to fix all of our problems.
Yeah.
The election is here. Are you ready?
I don't think I am when you describe it that way, anyway.
Well, we can only hope that everybody gets exactly what they're wanting, right?
But don't you see that we have made a god of this whole thing? I mean, this is bigger than any religious ceremony or gathering. What else in American society comes close to this? The Super Bowl? I don't know. I mean, look, the premise here is that democracy does a couple things. First, it creates compromises between us so that we can live with each other. In other words, nobody gets everything they want, but you get some of what you want. And we're seeing that that's not happening. It's just creating an entrenched oligarch, sort of a professional class in and around Washington, D.C., that governs us. So the idea that democracy is a form, is a way to mediate conflict and create compromise, I think, is not happening because we can see that our country is as conflicted as ever. So the second justification for democracy is that it gives, in effect, the consent of the governed. It expresses the consent of the governed. Well, that's increasingly not true in a country of 330 million people when you don't have any kind of true majority voting for anybody. So I don't like mass democracy. I don't like that the presidency is so powerful. I don't like that we put so much on this and that we are so emotionally invested in it. And It's getting worse. You know, I don't blame Trump. I think Trump is pushing back in many ways. But nonetheless, you know, there's a lot of hostility and anger for Trump, and there's a lot of loyalty for Trump as well. It's not going to be a pleasant week, I suspect.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very emotional for folks. It seems like the left, you know, when we think of politics as a religious exercise, it seems like the left are the fundamentalists of the state religion. Like, obviously, you have a lot of big believers in big government on the right, but they're just not quite as fully, you know, enmeshed in body, soul, and spirit. I mean, the left, this is everything. It's like cradle to grave. I want my Messiah. I need the Messiah. And the Messiah must do exactly the powerful magic tricks that they've promised us in anybody who stands in the way must be destroyed, fired, humiliated, and ran through in every way possible, right?
Well, there has to be something that replaces God and if in society. Now, the right still at least makes a claim to wanting a religious society with intermediary institutions, but the left has jettisoned it. And so the state and its rituals, which take the form of elections, become a religion. And people participate in them with the same kind of fervor, the same kind of faith-based outlook. You know, what we're seeing this week is religiosity, and in a secular sense. We're seeing state religion. And that's discomforting to people who think that government ought to be a referee over on the side of society, calling balls and strikes rather than this active participant.
Jeff, I want to know how many people would actually vote for a Joe Biden ticket. He is a you know, he's got 50 years of doing mass incarceration for every nonviolent thing and regulation, right? So I imagine,
right,
what if Joe Biden said, hey, here's my platform. We're going to promise, we're going to expand the prisons. Everybody's going to get a bed. Everybody's going to get 3 square meals. Everybody's going to get their medical care taken care of. Everybody's going to have a free stay, free place to stay, but we're just going to expand and modify all of our federal prisons, and everyone's allowed to come in if you vote for Joe Biden. How many millions of people do you think would actually go along with it?
Well, we almost have that with these lockdowns. I guess for most people, your house is a little nicer than the state prison, but still, the idea is the same. The idea is that would you give up liberty for security? And I think, you know, once you introduce that concept in society, a lot of people will say yes, or certainly a percentage of them will say yes. So that's always been what this is about, control over society. And, you know, Joe Biden may appear to be the kindly, grandfatherly type. He may appear to not be a radical, this kind of white-haired guy who we know from being, he's been in the Senate 47 years or something like that, well, Senate and White House as vice president. You know, oftentimes evil takes a very banal form. And, you know, when that's just a person in your neighborhood yelling at you in a store because you're not wearing a mask, for example, it's not always a jackbooted thug from some, you know, faraway military force. So I think Biden is the banal progressive, but he's also very dangerous and a very bad guy.
Well, Jeff, how many of those folks that yell at you in the store for not having a mask would go through the Stanley Milgram experiment and make sure they press the lethal shock to the guy on the other side who's been, who they've been told is not wearing a mask?
Right, and we see this in revolutions throughout history. Ordinary people do and say things that that you'd think they would never do. And so a revolutionary period in a country is really just a form of hyper-politics.
Mm-hmm.
The opposite of that, the antidote to that is the market. The market is a cooperative mechanism where we all get along. It's in our interest to be peaceable neighbors and deal with one another. So this is when a country is this politicized, almost by definition, it's already engaged in a revolution of sorts.
Right. Revolution is like late stage statism. It's just the same thing, but it's frayed. Its machinery is not well oiled, and it starts to kind of reveal the reality of the whole thing, which is a mob, right?
Well, when there's no shared underlying reality, and this is what postmodernism, which animates a lot of folks on the left, is all about, which is saying, you know, 2 + 2 can be 5. It depends. It depends on your identity. It depends on the historical context. It depends on oppressors and oppressed. It depends on class and race and gender and sexuality and all kinds of things. So we don't know that math is describing reality. It might just be a social construct. So once you sort of accept this mindset and there's no shared basis for organizing society, then what's likely to happen is that, you know, force is going to be used to organize society because there's no mutual cooperation. I mean, postmodernism is a recipe for social unrest in any civilization, in any country, in any nation, because you're basically saying there's no truth claims and there is no common understanding of what's right or even what's real. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we are headed in the United States.
Well, you know, I think it's a vestige of ancient myth. I think the ancient societies, they had mythologies, right? They would have special incantations that the priest would say, by the power of Ra, I get to rip your heart out because the whole community needs to serve the god. And that's the same thing we have with postmodernism. By the power of social justice and playing with words, we can make words violence and we can take you by force. We can destroy you by force. If you say the wrong word, we're going to socially construct it and have you taken down. We're going to take your money, humiliate you, lock you up if you oppose us. Look at how many people they've locked up in the Trump administration for nothing. The Democratic Party and the media have become the party of caging and bombs. That's all they are. That's their main, you know, hallmark now.
Yeah, foreign policy may be the worst thing about Biden. I mean, that's what's so remarkable here is this is not the party of JFK. This is not the party that wanted to bring peace to any part of the world. This is not the party that organizes around union halls for better wages and working conditions. This is the party of academia. This is the party of postmodernism, of wokeness. And most of all, it's a party of retribution. I mean, that's what politics has become now, the idea that America is intrinsically evil, and that their atonement has to be made for all this. So again, you know, over and over, I know it's cheap, I know it's easy, but you can't help but see over and over again the analogies to religion with all of this.
Well, I don't think it, I think you're speaking my tune. You know, that's what I love. Because, you know, when you look at it, let's look at the Gospels for a second. If you have your Bibles with you, please turn, or I'm just joking. So when we look at the Gospels, we'll see that it's clear that what's really running the show in the trial of Jesus is the crowd, right? You know, you have the king of the local community, King Herod. He can't figure out what to do. You got the general, the occupier of the empire, you know, Pontius Pilate. He's like, what's the big deal here, guys? I don't really see why we need to kill this guy. But ultimately, the text reveals that what really runs the powers of the world is the mob. The mob says, no, we want his blood, and therefore, you know, the state submits. And that's really what's going on here, is that, you know, yeah, there's a lot of crooks like the Biden family, but what's going on here is this is the passions of the crowd. The crowd wants envy. They want to take other people's stuff, and they want other people to be in pain, I guess, right?
Yeah, there's certainly an element of all of this that is, you know, it's punitive, that there are good and evil people in the world. This is no longer based on a biblical or religious conception of it. It's based on a political conception, which is ever-changing, and that, you know, certain people need to be shunned, vanquished, punished, perhaps even imprisoned. They need to be canceled. They need to lose their jobs. They need to lose their social media platforms. They need to lose their standing in society. They need to lose their career path, you know, and so I don't know about you, David, but I don't call any of this liberalism. I call it illiberalism.
Yeah, and it's certainly not progressive. It's reactionary, you know. It's not offering any real new ideas. It's not fun. It's not creative. It's not kind. It's not open-minded. It's not tolerant. I mean, what in the world is... I mean, there's not very much positive stuff about this new movement that's taking over politics.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is the fact that there is a very, very dedicated minority. And as small as they may be numerically, their insistence on their own correctness is so strong that they will do, you know, almost anything to push forward their agenda. And so that's why a small minority wins, because most people are just not wired that way. They're not going to get up in the morning and create contention or turmoil or havoc in their own lives, and they're not going to spend all their time standing, you know, yelling at police at an Antifa riot. I mean, they're going to go to work, they're going to worry about their kids, they're going to worry about their mortgage or their bum knee or whatever it might be. That's what most people do in life. And so when you do have this crazed political minority, they can have a very outsized influence, because that's their life. That's what they do. And they do it all day, every day, relentlessly. And I think that explains so much of what happened in the 20th century, which was in many ways illiberal in the sense that the U.S. government got far larger, more powerful, more warlike, fewer civil liberties, more taxes and regulations, but worse money. You know, all of these terribly illiberal things happened, but they happened gradually and incrementally because there's always a group of people out there pushing. And at some point, that does create a reaction, a backlash, whether that comes in the form of Trump or something else. And in a sense, they're almost hoping for that. They're almost engineering that, because that gives them a justification for what they do. So you have this question, who are the imposers, who are the imposed upon? And they're very good at turning that around and portraying themselves as the victims. And so Michael Rechtenwald, for example, the former professor at NYU, he says Antifa needs to create fascists to justify its own existence. And I think that's a pithy way of putting, you know, understanding what the left does. It almost creates a resistance by its own projection.
Right, and it makes you wonder. They talk a big deal about the danger of bullets, but I wonder about the danger of ballots. You know, there's a lot of violence that can be done with that little ballot, isn't there?
Well, you know, a huge percentage of the country is going to be, you know, it's not so much about policy or ideology, it's more about culturally. But a huge percentage of the country, no matter who wins, quote unquote, next week, is going to feel culturally vanquished to an extent. And that's, you know, that's partly because we've decided we have to control so much of the federal government rather than the state and local level. And it's partly because we've we've made a deity out of democracy, out of mass democracy, winner takes all. And if our system was a little more rational, if more decision-making was made at the state and local level, we might sort of view each other jokingly. We might say, you know, much like the French used to view the Germans. The French thought the Germans were uptight. The Germans thought the French were lazy or whatever. But nonetheless, that was part of the patchwork of what made Europe interesting. Whereas here, you know, the jokes about Californians or the jokes about red state voters in the South or whatever, they have a really nasty undercurrent to them, and so we have this deep psychological rift in this country, and it's very unpleasant, and this election is almost designed to intensify it.
So what would you tell if you had someone that was willing to listen to you for a few seconds or something, and they lose on Tuesday, whichever team loses? What would you tell them if they feel totally hopeless when their character doesn't win the ritual of the election?
Well, I think I would tell them to focus on things at home. I'd tell them that we still have a lot of freedom and material prosperity relative to almost any human who ever walked the earth historically, and that they should get busy with their own life. There's something pathetic, I would tell them. I would say there's something pathetic about having that much of your own identity or self-worth or happiness bound up in a political process, hundreds of millions of people all over the country, which you can't control. Do what you can. But beyond that, I think you have to have your psychological bearing to lead a good life, because allowing yourself to be demoralized seems to me the worst possible outcome.
Right, because then you're not fit to do what you need to do to take care of your family. So, Jeff, you know, this is interesting. The media really is excited. They want a great reset. You see the World Economic Forum saying the same thing. It's time for you to have a great reset. Time for you to sit in your house and watch Netflix all day and eat Impossible Burger goop, plant goop. They're going to tax your meat, tax your ribeye. You know, and they want this great reset real hard. They want it real fast, don't they?
Well, Time magazine even had a cover of the Great Reset on, and a lot of this is just the grab bag, the wish list that the left has had for years and years and years before COVID ever came along. And they're just using COVID as an excuse to reorder things. And a lot of what they want is to let people stay home and receive some sort of guaranteed income from the government, from taxes. So that's always been on their wish list, universal basic income. So that's coming to pass potentially already through enhanced federal unemployment benefits, but also potentially through the Biden administration actually legislating something like that. Rent moratoriums, I think, are a presage the left-wing desire for free housing. There's all kinds of things we can look at in COVID and say that the left is skillful at using a crisis to impose things like quarantines, to impose price controls, to impose restrictions on movement, to force businesses to close. I mean, it's exceedingly authoritarian, and it's all couched in this language of, well, we're trying to keep you safe. But Judge Napolitano points out that's not the government's job. Keeping us safe is our job. We can make our own decisions about the degree of risk out there, whether businesses ought to be open, that sort of thing. But it's a bit surprising and unnerving to see the willingness with which people have sort of rolled over for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you see that this Great Reset has been really ushered in, or trying to be ushered in, by a media that doesn't want to have any coverage at all about anything that makes their little story look bad, doesn't it? You know, the whole Hunter thing, you don't hear about that. Glenn Greenwald, a very noted progressive Pulitzer Prize winner journalist, he just resigned from his long outpost at The Intercept because he wanted to write something about Biden, and they said, no, can't do it. So This is a really Orwellian moment, for real.
Yes. It is. I think the media has never been more blatant in trying to shape and craft a narrative as opposed to report the news. But what's different, what feels different this time around, is that they're no longer trying to hide it or explain it away or apologize for it. They're increasingly brazen. People like Jake Tapper or Christina Amanpour at CNN or Wolf Blitzer or the MSNBC people, you know, increasingly they're just saying, you know, no, we're not reporting that. It's not real when it comes to the son of Biden. You know, I mean, the whole thing now has reached such an unpleasant, almost fever pitch. You have a sense that they're just throwing out all the stops and saying, we're going to do what we have to do in this last week or two to get Biden across the line.
And Joe, one of the saddest things that's come out of these Hunter Biden emails is just how cheap Joe Biden is. You know what I mean? You don't have to pay much. You basically give him an Egg McMuffin and a senior Diet Coke, and he'll sell out your whole country to Kazakhstan or wherever, you know?
Well, you know, he's certainly a guy who has, you know, compromised himself time and time and time again to stay in the Senate. You're never an impressive guy, always a very mediocre guy. Struggled in law school, plagiarized something in law school, which actually knocked him out of the presidential running earlier in his career in the Democratic primaries. So this guy is not impressive at all, but that, you know, you can understand that. There's a lot of mediocrities who make a long career in Washington, D.C. Now, Kamala Harris is a little different story because she's a mediocrity as well, but a true believer. So she has been sort of advanced because she's female and ostensibly a woman of color. So that's assisted her and given her a leg up throughout her career, which is mostly an unearned career. I mean, she had no business being attorney general. She had no business being a senator. She has no business being a vice president in terms of any accomplishments or intelligence or ability. But as a true believer, she's more dangerous than Biden because she really wants to bring this stuff home, to impose it on us.
Yeah. Well, she wasn't a true believer in freeing people of color with the First Step Act. She refused to work with them in passing that. So she doesn't care about real people and suffering. So, but if you had to bet, if you want to, who do you think is going to win next week? If you want to, you can. If you don't want to pass, that's fine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's awfully hard to say, but I will say that it's about perception, not the facts of who gets the most votes. And I think Left and Biden are better situated to create the perception beginning Tuesday night.
Interesting. Very good. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Jeff. It's always great to hear from the work that you guys are doing at Mises.org. I appreciate you.
Thanks, David.
And that's it for A Neighbor's Choice. Email us hello@aneighborschoice.com. Godspeed.